This is The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. In 2012, Time magazine named Walter Isaacson one of the most top 100 influential people. He also happened to be a former managing editor at Time. He's also the former chair of CNN, and he's now the president and CEO of the Aspen Institute. He's also written biographies on Kissinger, Einstein, Ben Franklin, and most recently, the bio on Steve Jobs. Tonight, Walter Isaacson will discuss Steve Jobs' life at Trinity University during the 2014 Flora Cameron Lecture on Politics and Public Affairs. That's at 7:30 p.m. at Laurie Auditorium. The lecture is free and open to the public. No tickets are required. Walter Isaacson, welcome to The Source.
Thank you very much, David. It's great to be with you. I'm here at beautiful Trinity University in the KRTU studios. It's a wonderful place.
Yeah, I'm sorry we couldn't give you better weather, but we're always happy when it rains in South Texas, so we never curse
the
rain.
Well, I'm from New Orleans. I'm used to the rain.
Okay. So when people find out that you wrote the bio on Steve Jobs, you had 20 interviews, you got to sit down, talk to him, discuss his life, the intimate details about his life, you really got insight into the mysterious, enigmatic Steve Jobs, mercurial, all the things Steve Jobs. What do people want to know when they know that you might be able to answer that question about Steve Jobs?
Sometimes they ask me what's the most surprising thing about Steve, and I always say that it was his emotionalism. I remember many times, as I describe in the book, that we'd be talking and suddenly he'd start crying or he'd get very passionate. And I think it was that passion for perfect products, you know, that passion to make a dent in the universe, as he said, that made him something special.
Now, Steve Jobs, incredible life story. He was adopted as a child. The adopted parents had to promise that they would give him a higher education, went to Reed College, a liberal arts school. It was a financial burden for the family. He dropped out, but he continued to take classes even though he wasn't enrolled. He studied things like calligraphy and style and design. And all that really went into the Steve Jobs, his creativity later in life.
I think one of the things that Steve illustrates, which I think about when I come to a place like Trinity University, is the connection between the humanities and the sciences. In other words, the people can connect arts and engineering, because he believed that beauty mattered. And when he dropped out of Reed, he stuck around to take courses, as you said, in calligraphy and design. So when you look at any Apple product, it not only works well, but it's beautiful. It's an object of desire. And I think that's where creativity will happen in the digital age, is those people who, like Steve Jobs, could stand at that intersection between the arts and technology.
But his passion for perfection, pushing people beyond what they thought that they could actually accomplish, something sometimes called his reality distortion field.
Remember that from Star Trek episodes when the aliens could conjure up a galaxy just based on sheer force of will. That's what they called Steve's reality distortion field.
And he was able to get people to do things that they didn't know they could do. They create things beyond their imagination.
You know, it even started back when he and Wozniak were working at Atari before they start Apple. And they're supposed to do a game called Breakout. And Steve says to Woz, you got to do it in 4 days because we got to get back to this Apple commune they were working on, which is why they called their company Apple eventually.
Yeah, it was an actual Apple orchard. It was not the company yet.
Right. No, it was just an orchard where they were working. They were working at the game company Atari, or at least Steve Jobs was. And he was on the night shift because he didn't believe he had to shower or use deodorant. So the chief engineer put him on the night shift. But he gets his friend Woz to help him do the game Breakout. Woz says it'll take him a few weeks. Steve just stares at him without blinking and says, don't be afraid, you can do it in 4 days. And Woz does it in 4 days. Over and over again in the history of Apple, Steve Jobs would just stare at people without blinking and say, don't be afraid, you could do it. And it drove people nuts. It drove them really angry, but it also drove them to do things they didn't think they were capable of. Even the glass that we have on the iPhone, Steve went to Corning Glass and told them exactly how they had to do it. And the head of Corning Glass said, well, no, that's not possible. And Steve kept saying, don't be afraid, you can do it. And that's why every piece of glass on your iPhones and iPads are all made in America by Corning.
The scratching of the glass doesn't happen like the first version, the beta version that he was first playing with. The keys in his pocket scratched the glass. He says, no, you got to make it better.
Exactly. He was somebody who, in any way, shape, or form, would not stand for imperfection. In fact, his father had taught him that you have to even be careful with the parts unseen. In other words, when they were building a fence, he said, we have to make the back of the fence just as beautiful. So when they did the original Macintosh, he loved the way the whole thing looked, but then he looked at the circuit board inside and the chips weren't lined up straight. And he said, it's ugly. And they said, well, nobody will see the circuit board. People won't know. And Steve said, yes, but you will know. And they hold up shipping that original Macintosh for 6 weeks until they can make the circuit board beautiful. So that was the passion for perfection that I'm talking about.
Our phone lines are open. If you got a question or a comment, want to talk about Steve Jobs or even Henry Kissinger or Ben Franklin, Einstein, or the next book I understand you're working on continues the innovators, how the digital age was invented. A lot of stuff to work with. Aspen Institute, that's amazing. I mean,
I can talk about Apple Computer too, yeah. My favorite company.
Yeah, so a lot there to talk about. The number is 614-8980, 614-8980. You could also email us your questions and comments to the source at tpr.org. So there was a Steve Jobs movie that came out not that long ago. I think it was last year with Ashton Kutcher. Mm-hmm. Did not do well, but that's not stopping them from making another Steve Jobs movie. And this one written by Aaron Sorkin, and apparently Christian Bale is being tagged to play Steve Jobs. And this is more closely related to your biography.
Right. This is the movie based on the book I wrote. And Aaron Sorkin, who's the smartest screenwriter, in fact, maybe one of the smartest writers we've had in our time, he did a screenplay that I think is absolutely phenomenal. And I think they're trying to get David Fincher to direct it. So this will be a very special movie based on my book, written by a guy who did, as you know, The West Wing, The Newsroom, and The Social Network, as well as many other great TV and movies.
So apparently it's three scenes, three 30-minute scenes that take place before Steve Jobs is supposed to announce the Mac, the Next Cube, and the iPod?
Well, that's what's been reported. I assume it's a little bit more complicated than that because Aaron Sorkin always weaves very, very rich tales filled with dialogue and super smart. I mean, that's what Aaron Sorkin's writing always is super smart.
That's going to be it's very different from the other movie, I'm sure. All right, we're going to continue our conversation with Walter Isaacson talking about Apple and Kissinger and other things. Steve Jobs, give us a call if you got a question or a comment. The number is 614-8980. Walter is going to be speaking tonight at Trinity University at 7:30 p.m. at the Lowry Auditorium. His lecture is free and open to the public, and no tickets are required. So if you're looking for something interesting to do tonight, there, put that on your calendar. This is The Source on KSTX, and we will be right back.
What are we on Earth? We are one people, with one will, one resolve, one cause. Our enemies shall talk themselves to death, and we will bury them with their own confusion. We shall.
On January 24th, Apple Computer will introduce Macintosh. And you'll see why 1984 won't be like 1984.
And that ad has been called one of the most iconic television advertisements ever. It was a breakthrough ad shown only once for a Super Bowl for the Macintosh. And we're talking about Steve Jobs, a life with Walter Isaacson. He wrote the biography about Steve Jobs after sitting down and talking with him, 20 different interviews with him. And tell us about that ad, Walter.
That's an amazing ad in 1984 because Steve Jobs was a rebel. He always felt he was fighting the big establishments like IBM or Microsoft. And so that ad, he's created this new machine, Macintosh. It comes after the Apple II, but it's a beautiful appliance. You can just take out of the box and plug in at home. It transforms the personal computer industry, but he wants to make everybody wants to make sure that everybody realizes that Apple users, Macintosh users, are the rebels, the crazy ones, the misfits. And so he does that rebellious ad. The board of directors of Apple tried to kill the ad. They just thought it was really weird. It was directed by Ridley Scott, the guy who did Blade Runner. And when the board saw it, they thought, this is horrible. But that ad becomes, just with one major airing, the most iconic and greatest ad in consumer history in the United States.
Yeah, but it didn't do what an ad's supposed to do. It didn't sell Macintoshes.
Well, it didn't show the product at all. And it did pretty well at first. I mean, Macintosh sales took off right after that ad. But you're right. The problem was not with the ad. The original Macintosh was underpowered, and it didn't have many applications for it. So after the initial excitement of Macintosh, it was kind of overpriced, underpowered. And within a year, by the beginning of 1985, it's clear that it's not as successful of a product as it should be. And the board of directors then fires Steve Jobs, which was one of the great mistakes of all time. He has to go in the wilderness for 12 years until the company finally brings him back in the late 1990s and needs him back to help save the company. So in some ways, the story of Steve Jobs is Shakespearean. It's like a restoration drama in which, the kid forms a company, he creates a great product, then the board of the company that he created fires him, and then eventually the company needs him back, and he ends up making it the most valuable company in the history of the world.
They needed his operating system, and he goes back and works for a dollar a year.
Well, Steve is always filled with complexity. He works for a dollar a year, and after a while, though, he starts taking stock options. He was not driven by the money. But also the money was symbolic, and at a certain point he wanted some. So in the end, he gets pretty rich working. It's not just really for a dollar a year, but he likes to fancy himself. As I said when we were talking about that 1984 ad, he likes to fancy himself the rebel, the counterculture hippie, so he doesn't want to look like he's working for a big salary. Everything about Steve has many layers to it.
Let's get our callers in on the conversation. Our phone lines are open, and the number is 614-8980, 614-8980. You can also email your questions and comments to thesource@tpr.org or write directly on our show page on our website at tpr.org. Ken has called in. Ken, welcome to The Source. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Oh, hi. My question is as follows. Steve Jobs obviously has a great aura to him and pulled Apple from the depths up to a great height. And although he worked for a dollar a year at a time, he obviously also made huge amounts of money with his stock and so on. He also was, as one can read, a great bully. There's nothing about his charitable or any other humane aspect to him. Did he, in fact, ever help anybody? Did he ever support any poor people or give to charity, or is it purely egotistical and self-satisfying?
All right, Ken, thank you for that question. You bring up
good
a great
question,
point.
Ken. And, Steve Jobs was not somebody who made a show of any philanthropy. He had a wonderful wife, Lorene Powell Jobs, and she is one of the great philanthropists of our day and generation. And she started College Track, really cared about education. When I asked Steve Jobs, why don't you do more philanthropically? When Bill Gates called him and asked him to be part of the Giving Pledge, Steve said to me, he said, I can do more helping education by creating a great iPad and great curricula for the Apple and the iPad products. And so I think, different people have different ways of doing things. I certainly think he would have been a better person had he focused more on philanthropic endeavors, but that's who Steve was. He focused really on his work and on making really great products, and I think we have to take him for who he is. Whenever I'd ask him about it, he'd say, well, you just have to take me for who I am. I am passionate about making great products, and I think my great products will help change the world and improve people's lives. And if Bill Gates or other people want to get involved in philanthropy, that's what they should be focused on.
Well, he has given a lot of money to Reed College. He's helped that college out quite a bit. And Bono has said that that Steve Jobs has given quite a bit of money to the anti-AIDS campaign for Africa.
Absolutely. Both Steve and his family have given money. Steve just was not very public about his philanthropy, and I don't think he really focused on it.
Now, back to this this image that he cultivated, was it a reaction to be anti-IBM?
I think Steve felt that he was part of the late 1960s, early 1970s hippie generation. He loved Bob Dylan. He was sort of felt like he was a member of the counterculture. He went to India to find his guru. So he liked to be anti-establishment. He liked to consider himself a misfit, a rebel. The other great ad he produces, besides the 1984 one we talked about, was the Think Different ad, the Here's to the Crazy Ones, the Misfits, the Rebels, those who think different. And so I think that was part of Steve's character, was he was not a coat-and-tie IBM suit guy, and he always felt he wanted to cast Apple as the underdog fighting the big companies like IBM.
There's a long list of all the innovations that Steve Jobs can be credited for creating the PC, computer animation, the way we get music, the way we use mobile phones, tablet computing. What did he consider his greatest accomplishment?
At the very end of his life, 2.5 years ago, I asked him that question. And I thought he might say the iPad, you know, because it was an amazing success of the iPhone, or the Macintosh. And he said no. Making good products is hard, but making a company that will always make good products is really hard. So I think the greatest thing that I've done is creating Apple, a company that always stands at the intersection of the humanities and technology, a company that always cares about having beauty and the arts in its DNA. And he had done that. He has created Apple Computer, which to this day is still the company that cares the most about making really good and really beautiful products. So if you asked him what was his greatest legacy, it wouldn't be any particular product. It would be Apple the company.
All right. More callers to get on the air. Our number is 614-8980, 614-8980. We're talking with Walter Isaacson. He is a former Time Magazine managing editor, former chair of CNN. I got to ask you about CNN. Don't let me forget that. President and CEO of Aspen Institute, written biographies. And one of them we're talking about, Steve Jobs, is going to be speaking tonight at Trinity University at 7:30. It's free and open to the public at Laurier Auditorium. No tickets are required. Kathy has called in. Kathy, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks. My question is, Steve Jobs died of cancer, and he died of it because he treated it with bull. Why would such a smart man be so stupid about something like that?
Well, as I said, there are many layers to Steve Jobs, a very complicated man. And we started off this show talking about his reality distortion field. He actually seemed to believe at times that the rules did not apply to him, that if he really willed something strongly enough, he could almost bend the rules of physics. That worked most of the time. He made beautiful products with beautiful, you know, the glass from Corning that I mentioned. But it doesn't work on cancer. And he did face his cancer in two different ways. There was always two sides to Steve Jobs, the romantic side that believed rules didn't apply to him, and the very scientific engineering side. So he at first treats it macrobiotically and by, you know, as you said, doing things that involved herbal treatments and the type of things that don't really cure pancreatic cancer. But he also then got his genes sequenced. He did a really lot of molecular technology treatments and does treat it medically. We have to remember that he lived for 8 or 9 years after his cancer was diagnosed. So I think at the end of his life, when we talked about some of his regrets, you're right. He probably should have, and he regretted that he did not treat his cancer right away, that he spent 9 months before he got operated on. But that's why it's a biography of a very complex person, because, you know, he didn't have a simple mind. He didn't just automatically say, let's do the conventional thing.
All right, Kathy, thank you for that call. So let's talk a little bit about CNN in the couple of minutes we have left. CNN seems to be on the ropes. It could use a Steve Jobs person to come in and put it back on track. Maybe that person's you, Walter, since you led it during some of its glory days.
Well, no, it's not going to be me. I think I had my stint there, and it's nice of you to say it was the glory days, but I'm not sure I truly understood cable TV. I think everything goes up and down. You see CNN actually doing well these days, MSNBC going down a bit. I think there's always room for good reporting for a cable news network that doesn't, that tries at least to be balanced and show and down the middle when it comes to politics. I think Fox has been a little bit more conservative, MSNBC a little more liberal. I think in our society we sometimes like very ideological or opinionated things when we listen to talk radio. But there's also a need to have people who, you can never be purely objective, but you can at least try. So I salute the people of CNN. It's probably not the greatest formula for getting the top ratings, but it's a good service, and it's actually a very lucrative, profitable, successful enterprise to get the high-class viewers that CNN gets. So I don't have a magic formula for fixing it. Maybe, David, you should go on over there.
All right. The innovators, how the digital age was invented, coming out soon in October. And any hints of what surprises in that book?
You know, there's a lot of women in the book because I think we ignore the role of women in technology. My book begins with Ada Byron Lovelace, who was Lord Byron's daughter. I talked earlier about being here at Trinity University, where the arts and the sciences are connected. She's the person who did that best of all. She starts the computer age. So,
all right, I guess
for the rest of the book to see how it turns out.
Fascinating. We'll be looking forward to that. Walter Isaacson speaking tonight at Trinity University, 7:30, Laurie Auditorium, free and open to the public. No tickets are required. Thank you so much for coming on The Source this afternoon.